You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing. Creator and host, Ken Vellante. Editor and producer, Peter Bauer.
This is Ken Vellante with the Something Rather Than Nothing podcast. And before we begin this episode, I would like to acknowledge that this episode is being recorded on occupied Native lands in the state of Oregon and the city of Albany, Oregon, which historically belonged to the Kalapuya tribe. I'm very excited to introduce Rosalie Fish, who is a member of the Muckleshoot and Cowlitz tribes, and very excited to have her as a guest on this podcast to talk about her her advocacy, about her running, about herself, and about art, and a bit of bigger questions around philosophy. So I just wanted to really just welcome you, Rosalie, and thank you for taking the time to join this podcast.
Yeah, thank you. I would just like to start off to introduce myself in my language. Wiyats Askechad, Rosalie Fish Sitsta, Buckleshoot Abshad. So I just said, hello, my name is Rosalie Fish, and I live on the Muckleshoot Reservation. And so my native language is called the Hushootseed language, and that's what I practice and make an effort to introduce myself in.
Yeah, thank you for doing that. Could you tell us a bit about, you know, where you come from, your tribe, and maybe your earlier years, what your experiences were, or what type of, you know, young child you were?
Yeah, definitely. So I was born on the Muckleshoot Reservation, where I lived with, I had two families since my parents were divorced, so two separate nuclear families that I lived with. And I was also a big part of my Muckleshoot Canoe family and my powwow culture. So I really did grow up with that community, with my reservation, and really with my traditions and my culture. It was very important to me growing up and still is. I spent a lot of my childhood dancing at powwows, performing with my canoe family, and singing traditional songs at events. And these types of practices have really just become part of who I am. And when I go home, it's honestly, it's every day, just my part of my everyday schedule is getting out to those cultural events and being with my family and being with my community, because it really is, while I have my own nuclear families, our community is very united and very present with the way that we interact with each other and with our culture.
And you had mentioned some of the things that, you know, you do with the traditional dance and music. Was art in culture and expression a big part of, your formative years? I mean, I know you mentioned that, but could you go into a little bit more about the things you experienced and how it created a way that you relate to, you know, your culture and your art?
Yeah, absolutely. There's what I really love about my traditional cultures and the things that come with that are the various forms of art that I'm able to express myself in and also express my identity and my heritage. So one is that I've mentioned a few times and is very universal around Native American communities is powwow. And so we have different categories of dance within powwow culture. And there's one specific story about the jingle dress type of dance. And it's about a young girl who is sick, and then she's given a jingle dress, and they say, have her dance in this jingle dress, and it will heal her. And that's kind of the, I guess, the origin of some of these powwow dances and traditions, is that it's meant to heal. A lot of our art forms are meant for spiritual healing. And so that's how I guess, my culture and my dance and my art, different forms of art and expression, have really become important to me as a Native American individual, because they do represent methods of healing and methods of also ways to connect with our heritage and with the things and the people who have made it possible for us to be here today.
Thank you for that. I want to go to the importance of running for you, and in particular, for some listeners, it'd be no secret that you became quite well known in the press, and as far as your appearance of having a red painted hand over your mouth, and also on your leg, the initials MMIW. Can you tell us about where that, what made you decide that? And I know that you adopted that that act from another that had done it, a runner who had run on a Boston Marathon, and I believe she's taken on a mentorship role. Can you take us through your decision to do that and what that path has been like for you?
Yeah, definitely. I can start at the very beginning when I found out about the missing and murdered Indigenous women epidemic. It's a crisis that has been recently named, and it pretty much encompasses the institutional and social issues that create a very, very vulnerable environment for Indigenous women. So Native American women are extremely vulnerable to all forms of violence and are experiencing violence at much higher rates than any other demographic within the U.S. So an example of this would be in some counties, Native American women are 10 times more likely to be murdered than the national average. Along with this, high rate, that means that murder is a third leading cause of death in Native women. And so, unsurprisingly, living on a Native American reservation, I saw a lot of this violence against women. And it wasn't until I became a little bit older that I realized that the violence that was happening on my reservation was actually present in Native communities across the United States and even in Canada. And that's when I really felt like this was something that needed to change. And more importantly, it was something that the world needed to see, because I wasn't seeing any type of acknowledgement. I was 16 years old at the time, and I saw no articles about women going missing, or I didn't see any news coverage when a community member was murdered. And so that that led me to become inspired by the Boston Marathon runner Jordan Marie Daniel, who she took a stand and she decided to do something when she painted a red handprint over her mouth, along with the initials MMIW down her leg during her Boston Marathon run. And she raised a lot of awareness about this epidemic. And she showed me through her example that I could do something. I was a runner and still am. And she showed me that I didn't need to be well known or even really an adult to make a difference. I just had to have a platform.
Yeah, and it's a striking visual, and I think that's part of why it's so effective. And to be quite plain with you, I mean, it's effective for me because I did not know the scope of the issue, or even that it had been just the extent of the issue, in that, you know, how it was being talked about and or not being talked about and ignored. But within your community, what was the reality of, you know, outside of your visibility, how long has there been a vying to get attention over this issue in the kind of general public sphere and public policy and legislators? I mean, how long has this been going on?
And unfortunately, this type of violence has been occurring for generations, for I would even say like decades. I even, during the Siege of Wounded Knee, kind of based in the late 1800s, I'm reading this book by Mary Crowdog called Lakota Woman, and she's talking about her experience as an activist. And reading it, she even mentions female Native American activists going missing and nobody talking about it. And so this has been going on since colonial times. And just now it's starting to get some light brought onto it and to really have a name focused on it. Because at first it really was just, this is the way that our lives are and we have no control over it. And now that with the Urban Indian Health Institute, who's in Seattle, they actually got some research together. They went out on very little resources because nobody was really supporting them. And they found all of the information they needed to really put some numbers on this and get also a diverse number of cases from all across the U.S. that showed not only is this happening at extreme rates, but it's happening all over the country. And so I think a lot of, it wasn't necessarily that Native communities didn't know it was happening. It was more, we didn't realize that it was happening to all of us. And we didn't realize that it could or should be named, it should be known, and more importantly, that it should be addressed, because we're just now, and I mean in 2019, finally getting a little bit of acknowledgement from these bigger populations and even legislation.
And one of the things at the beginning of the podcast with the land acknowledgement that I announced, we had a pause of about 10 seconds, and I was correlating that to that ratio of 10 times that in some counties, Native American women are 10 times more likely to be murdered than the national average. It's an absolutely shocking and astounding thing to hear, you know, as a human. And for me, I got to tell you, Rosalie, I mean, I'm extremely inspired by what you've done. And I would actually say that you're a hero of mine in the sense that the what you're doing is great and important, and I affirm it. But for you, it places you in a difficult position as advocating as you are and doing so visibly. What has been the reception to your running, to your act, to your bringing awareness to this issue? What's that been like for you?
I think being an advocate for my people and for my community is very rewarding in a lot of ways. To do nothing is to give up, and each day that's what keeps me going, is to know that I can never give up. That's one of the most painful things that I can do. No matter, you know, how emotionally scarring or emotionally tolling some of the work I do and you know, the cases that I read, it can be very, just very heavy. But I think to not do anything is much more of a disappointment. It would take much more of a toll, you know, on my psyche and my emotional health if I were to ever stop. And I think a very big misconception about activists, and especially Indigenous activists, is it feels like something that we chose to do, which is not always the case. I would say that I didn't necessarily aim to be an activist or to be in the public eye, but rather I was tired of seeing my communities live in a way that was in violence. And I was tired of seeing Indigenous women, Indigenous girls become targets. And I was tired of living in fear. And so I wouldn't necessarily say that I wanted to be an activist, but more, I could not accept the conditions that Indigenous people were living with anymore.
Yeah. And thank you. I know the importance, just from hearing your TED Talk, and listeners, Rosalie has a TED Talk that she had presented in Seattle that you can find on YouTube. I highly recommend that you listen to that. But in listening to those things, I felt and knew after listening to you how important running was for you, both physically and mentally. And that kind of spurred my thinking. I had mentioned to you my brother's a runner, and I'm very close to my brother. He lives out east. But I think I saw for him experientially and what it did for him in his teenage years, just that outlet, just that place to put all the energies that we have inside of us as humans. I think we need to put them places. Mm-hmm. For you, what is running done? Just specifically you running and excelling in running, what has it done for you as a person?
So I kind of consider my running and how my relationship with it in three stages when I talk about it. So I first started running actually as a method of recovery because I was recovering from a suicide attempt. I was in my ninth grade year of high school, and I was struggling with my mental health and with my environment socially, and I was in a very bad place. And the one thing that would keep me healthy and keep me on track and stop me from relapsing was running, because it, like you said, it gave me that outlet and it gave me a place to go when I felt like I had nowhere to go and I knew that I didn't want to be there wherever I was. As it can feel like you're stuck, and running gave me somewhere to go. And so that was how running initially became an outlet for me. And then I moved to a tribal school, Muckleshoot Tribal School, my sophomore year, where I ran track and field there. And that was when I really began to notice the bias and prejudice that can appear in sports. So sometimes I would try to go to a track meet where my time had qualified, but because I had Muckleshoot Tribal School on the uniform, they wouldn't accept me. And I faced a lot of just discrimination because of my school and where I came from and it being a tribal school. And so then running took its second form, where I used it as a sign to stand up for myself. Now I could show up to meets, and with tribal school, Muckleshoot Tribal School, on my uniform, I could win and I could prove these biases wrong. And so that's how the second stage of my running took place, was really just through battling discrimination that I faced in sports and to represent my community in a positive light where I had control, right? And then the last stage, and the stage that I'm in now with my running, is now I can use running to actually demand acknowledgement. And so that's what I did with the red handprint at my state track meet in Washington of 2019, is I painted the red handprint over my mouth as a way to represent the historical violence that has happened through my ancestry, and even with my great-grandparents and my grandma and my mom even. It's to represent them and the historical violence that they faced and the way that people have tried to silence this movement. And so that's what I used the red handprint on my face for, along with the letters MMIW, just as Jordan Marie Daniel did. And so that was how I was able to demand acknowledgement. I was able to represent not only my people, but an issue that affects us very greatly. And that's the stage that my running has taken on now.
Yeah. And did you, when you started running, did you expect to excel at it like you have?
No, I definitely never anticipated that I would be too good of a runner, for sure. I didn't even actually think that my freshman year of high school, I didn't think that I would even be going to college or running in college.
Yeah. And what in particularly, what distances and events do you run?
So at my state track meet, I dedicated four Indigenous women to four events. So at my state track meet in my senior year of high school in 2019, I ran the 400-meter race, the 800-meter race, the 1600-meter race, and the 3200-meter race. Now, here that I'm a freshman in college, I run anywhere from the 800-meter race to the half marathon.
And it's quite an array, of events. And I'm glad to hear, you know, about your success in doing that. And I'm also glad for the place that it's held in your life. I when I was younger, I ran, but I didn't continue doing it. And through my brother, I've known a lot of runners. And I think there's something special about runners that I've always connected to. Like, just, they're a motley crew, and they have this streak in all of them. And I've just always appreciated, I've always appreciated that. There's a question that I was wondering about when you placed the red handprint on your face. I mean, was there a sense in talking about art, that did you feel like that was an artistic expression that you were doing away from the politics? But did you feel like that was a part of your cultural expression and an artistic statement of sorts?
Yeah, I would definitely say that really the handprint is very artistic in the things that it represents and how powerful it is. Everybody that I've spoken to says that the handprint really affected them, that it struck them and it really stopped them in their tracks even. And I think that's because even when I wear the handprint, it is very overbearing to me. The handprint, it really does represent a hand holding your mouth closed, like you can't speak. And I think a great example of that is Indigenous people in general and activists during the American Indian Movement were killed and supposedly gone missing, right? They were murdered and hidden as a symbol to say, you know, that we don't, that the bigger and dominant cultures and populations did not want Native people to have power or did not want them to strive for better lives. And it really is a way to represent all types of violence that have silenced Native people from speaking and from having a seat at the table. And so I think when people see that handprint, I think it relays it very accurately. And that's why it's so striking, is because it is a very powerful and very heavy topic. And it's something that I even struggle with when I put on the paint. I do feel heavy. I feel that emotional weight that a lot of my ancestors and people who are still alive today who are above me who have faced this type of violence.
Part of what you've done, and you alluded to it, to the four women that you ran for, and I think that's in the background of the, you know, what's on your body when you run, in the background of who you're running for. What has that experience done for you as far as running, creating visibility for those that, you know, are forgotten or at risk of being forgotten or ignored? What is that? How's that impacted you when you're running for them?
I think that running for Indigenous women is a very almost bittersweet feeling. It's a very painful thing to do. And so it really does depend on how I look at it, how much strength I have when I'm thinking about this, because there are days where it's easy to be and feel a little bit weak about this topic. It's easy to feel like, and just really think and absorb the sadness that the relatives have when they're talking about their daughter or sister or mother who is no longer with them because of this neglect, this institutional and social neglect. And it's really something that, based on your perspective, it can be either way. It can be something that is empowering, that I get to demand acknowledgement, and it can be something that is very overbearing and emotionally tolling.
Yeah, and do you still So what's happening now? I mean, you still run with the handprint on and bringing visibility to MMIW. Have you found that there's kind of this continued attention with you running with that now? Does it feel like kind of just part of who you are compared to when, you know, you first started doing it?
I would say that I've seen a lot of progress within the last year that I genuinely did not anticipate. I'm seeing missing and murdered Indigenous women cases being picked up by these large media and news companies. I'm seeing these big, powerful infrastructures actually starting to take a stance. And I'm seeing it addressed even with our presidential candidates and with our president. And I'm very optimistic about the changes that are in place and in the laws that are being discussed that will create efforts to protect Indigenous women and girls, and also with that, right, and protect all women, I think.
It's great to hear that there's been progress on this, and I'm really glad that you're talking about it. And I in the back of my mind, you know, I always wonder about the news cycle and the attention, you know, that can be paid to this. But I think it's been quite inspiring, both your actions and also seeing, even just following, you know, the hashtags related to the advocacy of MMIW and its connection to larger struggles I've seen in Canada over the pipeline plans, and just kind of these continued affront and attacks against Native peoples. Seeing these issues being connected in that way has brought me greater awareness on, you know, what is happening. And I've just been excited to see that it's been a larger connecting to larger issues overall, and it's inspiring. And I really hope and will do everything I can, and hope listeners will, to make sure we, you know, discuss this issue and see some changes. Like I said, it was just shocking to hear that this was going on. I know, not being a Native myself, but haven't studied a lot of Native American history, I know there's large components of this that are deep within the history of this country. But I'm still hopeful with all your action and many others that will continue to see progress, and actually just quite resistance to what we've seen. Connected to that, Rosalie, there's the main question in the show that I posed to you of, why is there something rather than nothing? And I also mentioned it in a couple of different forms of, like, you know, are you trying to create, you know, visibility from erasure? Are you trying to give voice to where there's been silence? But I was just wondering, your answer, however you want to take it, to the question is, why is there something rather than nothing?
For me, when I think about you know, that something, that thing that really gives you passion to keep going, to go against the current, or maybe even just to not stay stagnant, to not stay still, to keep moving, is for me, that something is the effort and the resilience that I've seen through my ancestors. It's the resilience that I see who my great-grandparents, who were actually in boarding schools and who have, despite that, done their best to raise normal, happy, healthy families, despite what was taught to them, which was violence and abuse. And through that, I'm seeing, even in the American Indian movement and these types of, I guess, activists that were before my time, who were fighting for my rights, and even who's now affects the rights that I have today, and how I'm able to maneuver in my environment and in the environment of the U.S. And it's that's a something, I would say, that is better than nothing.
Absolutely. Rosalie, I was wondering, and I think it's super important to give you this time to help steer me, help steer folks who are interested both in learning about this issue, the history of it, and also advocating for it. If you could let folks know how they may connect to whether it's you, to the issue, where to find resources, where to learn more, what mm-hmm. to read, who to listen to, those type of things. Can you guide us through from your perspective what would be helpful in following up?
Yeah, absolutely. The Urban Indian Health Institute, so they're just UIHI. So they're in Seattle, but they have a website, and they are so amazing with their data collection and with creating some numbers that actually give us evidence and support when we're trying to advocate for this issue. And so that's one organization that I always tell people to go check out to read their things, because their reports also are very easy to read. They make them actually artistically very visual, but also very accurate and understandable at the same time. So that's one institution that I would totally recommend that anybody supports, just because they are very good at what they do. Another organization that is very impactful is the Sovereign Bodies Institute. That's just another one that is continuously fighting for Indigenous rights and our rights as sovereign nations, as nations that are in compliance with the U.S., but also separate in a few ways. And then I think one thing that a lot of people can do, or honestly anybody can do as long as they have a social media account, is to, when they see missing or murdered Indigenous women posts, missing persons posters, to share them, even though it's really just a way to get our relatives' names out there and to make sure that they're seen and that they're visible. And I personally share all of the posters and information that I see on my social media, and there's also various social media accounts that their whole page is dedicated to finding those posters that have been neglected by their local media and news sources, and sharing them on their pages so that they're seen.
Thank you for that. And what I've seen is that there seems to be more reporting on this, and I've even seen a couple books. One I think was entitled The Highway of Tears, around this issue, and I think it's safe to say we're seeing more. Would it be safe to say published reports and in writing about this issue?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm seeing a lot more support, and just more and more evidence gathered. The more that we're showing there's a need to research this issue, we're getting more support to put the funds into doing so, into publishing works about it, and therefore creating a lot more awareness. I really think that the awareness level that the MMIW epidemic has right now has been one of the highest that it's ever been.
And thank you for your work on that. Again, Rosalie Fish, our guest on this episode. Again, Rosalie, you're absolutely inspiring, and I appreciate the acts of courage that you have taken in order to connect me with this issue, and hopefully connect others to make progress in an issue that I know has impacted you directly and your people directly. And I think it impacts all of us when something of this scope and this nature is happening. I think it's all of our issue, and I don't think it's a separate issue for humans who care about one another. And I think I just find what you've done inspiring. I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us about this. And also one other thing, Rosalie, mm-hmm. I want you to win all your races. I want us to win. I want us all to win as humans. in making this a safer place for you, for all of us and your people. I want to thank you deeply for spending the time with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's very reassuring to know that there are allies out there who, just like as you said, who take this issue as their own. And that to me is all the progress, you know, that I need to see is when I see somebody who wants this issue acknowledged, addressed, and eventually fixed. I mean, that's great, honestly. Thank you.
Rosalie Fish, thank you so much, and hope to talk to you again soon.
Yeah, definitely. Me too.
Bye now.
You are listening to Something Rather Than Nothing.